So today we shall be starting this very powerful text called Gyan Sar. And last week, the points are on the right side. We had summarized briefly. I had given a brief introduction to what is knowledge and what is the knowledge that we are seeking. One is worldly knowledge and one is that knowledge in the light of which everything is known. Because I am alive, because I have this mind and intellect, because of that consciousness, because of that life principle, I'm able to function and know everything else. So the essence of this text is to take us within to that higher knowledge, knowledge not of the world, but the knowledge of myself. So today we shall cover this particular board. As we said, Gyan Sar means essence of knowledge. And this text, as I mentioned last week, was written by Guruji Swami Tejomayananda, who is the worldwide head of Chinmaya Mission. And this text consists of 18 verses. The first verse is an invocation to the Lord and to the teacher, which we shall study today. Because when we begin anything auspicious, we always have to remember the Lord, like as we do in our class here also every Thursday. So this text starts with an invocation. Verses 2 to 6 talk about the qualities of a student. What is required for a person to be ready for the spiritual journey? How do I become a qualified student? And that is covered in that. I'll talk a little bit about it today, but in detail we'll cover over the next few weeks, because we are all on this spiritual journey. And how am I to prepare? Just as, say, if I'm going on a trek, you know, up to Mount Whitney, then I have to have certain basic preparation. I have to have a tent. I have to have food supplies. I have to be physically in good shape. You know, I have to work out for a few months before that. I have to be mentally strong because, you know, the journey is tough. So here also, verses 2 to 6 prepare us for this knowledge. Verse number 7 to 12 is the actual heart of this matter, of this book, which talks about what is the Gyan Sar, what is the essence of knowledge. And then the 13 to 18 verses talk about the glory and the benefit. Because whenever we study something, we want to know what am I going to get? Like, you know, a few of you are here. Now, why am I here? Am I going to get anything out of this class? So unless there is some benefit, there is no. So that is the briefly about the text, which we shall cover in more detail. Now, I'll read the text. I'll read the first verse. You can repeat after me, and then we shall go into detail about it. Verse number 1 is on page 3, I think, in the text. Aradhyam paramam ramam natva bhaktya cha sadgurum Jnanasaram pravakshyami Swatmanishthaika siddhaye. So, Ramam, here Ram is a manifestation of God. You know, we say that God has, you know, 1,000 forms. In fact, in the Quran, it says Allah has 100,000 names. So there are a lot of names of God. You can call him Father in heaven. You can call him Jesus, Buddha, Krishna, Shiva, Allah, and so on. But here we believe that God appeared on earth in two times. One is as Krishna and one is as Ram, where he directly manifested as a human, just as Christians believe that Christ was the Son of God. God himself appeared on earth as Christ. And most people in India worship either Krishna or they worship Ram. And then, of course, there are others who worship Mother Goddess, Ganpati, Shiva, and so on. But Rama appeared on earth many years ago, few thousand years ago, was a prince. And he actually did not show any of his divine powers, even though he was the Lord incarnate. He acted like a normal human being. He was a prince, of course, but his purpose of incarnation, appearance, was how I should live my life. What is an ideal way to live the life? So he was an ideal son to his father. He was an ideal husband to his wife, ideal brother to his brothers, ideal parent, ideal friend, you know, people whom he befriended. He did everything to help them, protect them. And he was even an ideal enemy. Even his greatest enemy, who had vowed to kill him and had kidnapped his wife, at the last moment when the enemy was defeated, he said, okay, even today, you just tell me that you made a mistake, return my wife, and I will spare you. Of course, the enemy was not ready. He said, I'm going to fight till the last breath. But the point was that when you read Ramayana, the story of Ram's life, we see how we should live our life, how one should deal with our relationships. He was an ideal king. So that's why he says, I prostrate to Lord. In this case, it is Rama. You can put here, of course, Krishna or Jesus. It doesn't matter. But for Swami Tejomayananda, in Hinduism, people say, oh, that you have many gods. Like, you can see pictures of so many gods and goddesses. But we don't say that we have many gods. We say there is only one God called Brahman, or the total consciousness, the substratum of the universe. The one that is the creator and sustainer of this whole universe. The universe emerged from that one consciousness. But then that all-kind, compassionate, merciful Lord gave us birth and wanted us to remember our Lord, our Creator. And sometimes it becomes very difficult to contemplate upon a formless, all-pervading substratum reality. It's too complicated. So he gave us all these beautiful forms. So you can pick. If you love Mother Goddess, that's fine. If you love Ram or Krishna, whatever form of God you love, you develop a relationship. So Ram is the form that is chosen in this text. And he says, Aradhyam Paramam Ramam. He is the greatest. For me, he is the greatest. He is the one I love the most. And he is Aradhyam. He is most worshipful. He is most divine. And Natva Bhaktya. And I bow down to that Lord with devotion. Devotion is very important for a spiritual seeker. Love and devotion. Devotion is love accompanied by the right understanding. Who is this God I am worshipping? And then he says that, and Sadgurum, and also the Guru. I bow down to my teacher and I bow down to the Lord. And he says, Jnana Saram Pravakshyami. Jnana Sara is this text. He says, Pravakshyami. Vakshyami means I shall speak. When the prefix pra is put, pravakshyami means prakarshena vakshyami, means I'll say something that is very beneficial, that is very good. And why? Sva atma nishtha eka siddhaye, just for abidance in my own nature. So the teacher who has composed this text, he has not composed it so that it may become a bestseller, you know, on the New York Times bestseller list. Maybe a million copies may be sold. He's not writing it so that may I get a lot of disciples. He writes it so that by composing these verses, he can experience a little bit of that self-abidance, little about that self-truth. And he hopes that by sharing it with others, and if others read, he is hoping that they also benefit and they also go inward to experience that same inner truth which Swamiji, Swami Tejomayananda, has experienced. Now, why do we begin anything with an invocation? You know, they say, like, if you're building a new house, you must pray, you must, you know, get the Lord's grace and blessings. If you're going up to for a job interview or if you're going for an exam, we always tell the children, you know, you must pray before you go. Of course, then some of the Indians also do elaborate rituals. They may call a priest to do some prayers. The purpose of prayer and prostration to the Lord and the teacher is threefold. First of all, you want that the job should be complete. You know, when I start to do a job, when I want to build a house or when I, you know, want to take a test or when I want to start some factory or some new project, I want that the job should be completed. Nobody wants to leave it half complete. So the first purpose of prayer, which one should, and that's what one should do, is every morning before we leave the house, we must, if you have a prayer room or if you have a little picture of God or a crucifix or something, always bow down and always ask the Lord's blessings and grace to be with me as I go about my work today. Then also before you go to bed at night, one should always thank the Lord again for giving us this day and for being with us. So that is the first reason that I should successfully complete the project. The second reason to pray is that there may be obstacles, there may be problems in my work or in my day or in my, you know, whatever I have decided to undertake, like writing of this book. You know, maybe he might get a thought block and suddenly ideas may not come. So the second purpose of prayer is that may all the obstacles be removed. And so we always say, oh Lord, please take care of the problems. You are with me. As long as you are with me, there will be no problems in my life, no obstacles. And the third and the most important reason why one should pray to the Lord and to the teacher, because it gives us humility. Because we feel that I know so much, I have done so much. In the worldly, ego, of course, is bad, you know, to have arrogance about money or good looks or power or wealth or position or whatever. But worse than that is the spiritual ego, that I am spiritually evolved, I meditate so much, I know so much, I have studied, you know, So that's why one has to realize that nothing in this world can be accomplished without the grace of the Lord and the grace of the teacher. So whatever I am today, whatever I am has been given to me by the Lord. And whatever knowledge I have acquired over this few years, since right from the first time when I spoke my first word that was taught to me by my mother, she was my first guru. And then going on to my, you know, my school teachers and college and my golf pro and my tennis and, you know, they are all teachers. They are all gurus too. And, you know, at my work, I was an intern or I was an apprentice and my, you know, my foreman or whoever taught me to work, my mother who taught me to cook. But highest importance we give to the spiritual teacher, Sadguru, Sadguru, because the spiritual teacher is the one that removes our spiritual ignorance. And they said, unless your spiritual ignorance is removed, your journey in this life is incomplete. And the spiritual teacher should have two qualities. One is the teacher, he or she should have the knowledge, should have studied the scriptures. And secondly, he or she should abide in this knowledge. He should have some personal experience of this knowledge through meditation, through study, through self-abidance. So Shrotriyam Atma Nishtham. So that Brahma Nishtham. So that teacher should be knowledgeable and should have abidance in the knowledge. So that is why we should prostrate to the Lord and the teacher, the Sadguru. Then he says, what is the essence of this knowledge? Why? What is this knowledge? It is the essence of the Upanishads. Upanishads are the most ancient texts of India, which are the highest knowledge of the Vedas. The Vedas are four and they have our spiritual knowledge. But the end of that or the highest is the knowledge of who am I? Who am I? What is this world and what is my relationship with this world? So they take you inward. Now the Upanishads are very hard to understand. You might take 5 years, 10 years, you know, sitting at the feet of the teacher and and asking and discussing. So I don't have that much time. So he says, okay, how much time you have? He says, I have a weekend. That's all I can give. He says, if you have a weekend, this is it. In one weekend, you can actually read this text, but we, of course, will take a few weeks. We may take 3 or 4 months because I like to go slowly and go into the depth of each verse. But this is a kind of text that can be done in a weekend camp, like there is a camp going on now in Northern California. Some of the people here have gone. So this kind of text can be covered by a teacher in a weekend. So it is like a brief explanation of the essence of the Upanishads. Now, who is a qualified student? We'll talk in more detail over the past few weeks, but basically a qualified student is one who is dissatisfied, who is unhappy with the status quo. I mean, he'll say, materially, I have everything, health is okay, and, you know, world has given me a lot, especially in this country. We are blessed with so much, but there is something missing. There is some problem because of which I get unhappy, because of which I get stressed. And I feel that even though I acquire this and get that, and it's like a never-ending search. So is there a place where this thirst will end, this search will end? And such a student is called a qualified student who has seen the world, but then feels this is not enough. There has to be something better than this. And if you have that search, then you are a qualified student. Now, what is the benefit of self-knowledge? Why should I get it? Why should I study this text? And I have this beautiful story, the king story. If from this class, if you don't take anything else, just remember the story and your purpose of this class will be served. It's the most beautiful story. And I think everybody should think about it more and more. So there was this king who was very nice, very good person, ruled very well. His only bad habit, you know, all of us have some habit or the other, he loved to drink. But he would do it secretly. You know, he didn't want his subjects to think, you know, he was an alcoholic and he didn't want it to affect his work. So he would drink only at night, in the evening. What he would do is after the day's court is over and everything is over, he would drink in secret. But see, he didn't even want his servants or, you know, the people from his family to know. So in the back of his palace, right close to his bedroom, there was a very thick door, you know, thick wooden door. And he had the key, and that led out the back. And from the back door, there was a little courtyard, like a little garden. And then he could go to his prime minister, his chief minister's house. And so he had a key to the chief minister's house, and he would go into the back of his house. And the chief minister, of course, knew why the king was coming. And there was a room where all his liquor was stocked. And so he would go there, have a few drinks. And then in a happy mood, he would come back and he would have the key. He had a golden key which opened the gate, that heavy door. Only he had the key, nobody else. So he would take that key, come in from the back door, slip into the house and go to sleep, and nobody knew about it. So one day it so happened that he had a little extra to drink. He drank more than he usually drank. Instead of 4 or 5, maybe he had 7 or 8 drinks. And he was drunk. He was completely drunk, and he was really had no idea what was going on. But anyway, he is walking now through the garden back into his own house from the prime minister's house. And it was raining, started raining heavily, heavy rain. It was so drenching, very strong. I don't know if you have been to India and seen those monsoon rains. I mean, within a few minutes, you get like an inch of rain. It's very heavy. And he was completely soaked, and the thunder was there and the lightning was there, and he was shivering in the cold. And so somehow he found his way back to his back door. Now, it so happened that he forgot he had the key in his pocket. And he's trying to push the door, you know, and the door doesn't open. And he's banging on the door hard, "Let me in, let me in." The door is locked, and the door is so thick that even people inside can't hear him. He had designed it. And he kept on banging, and he kept on crying. And he was miserable, and it kept raining on him, and the water is dripping, and he's unhappy, you know. He said, "Look, I am so miserable out here. I am so cold." And inside, his servants had set up a sumptuous dinner for him because they knew the master will be coming, the Lord. And the room was warm and well lit and all the best foods and the best, you know, anything from the in the room. And he has this beautiful room, beautiful palace. And he's out there suffering in the cold and crying and beating. Can't get in. And he says, what am I to do? And, you know, he was so drunk, he didn't know that he had the key and had a key with a keychain in his pocket. And he's banging and crying and banging and nothing happened. So happened that there was one maidservant who was very loyal to him. And she knew, even though he didn't think that she knew, but she knew that where my master is going, where the Lord is going. And so she figured that he hasn't come back. Something is wrong. Now, she couldn't open the door because she didn't have the key. You only had to have the key to open. So she peeks through the keyhole and she sees the king over there. And he says, Jahapana, you know, means like, oh, great king, you can open the door. He said, what are you saying? She says, look, in your pocket, you have that golden key. You can open the door. You can come in. You can. But she has to whisper because she doesn't want the other servants to know that she's talking. So she's softly whispering and trying to tell the king that you have the key in your pocket. Now, we may laugh at the king, but we are exactly the same. There is no difference between him and us. Because we are also drunk with this ignorance of this self-knowledge. Because we are drunk because we know about the world, but we don't know about who we are. So we have drunk this alcohol of arrogance and pride and ego, thinking that I am somebody, I can do something, I am special, I have this power. So that arrogance, that pride, that ignorance makes us drunk. Where we know a lot about the world, we know about objects, emotions, and thoughts, but we pay no attention to the inner self because that is concealed from us because of this. And then we say we suffer. You know, we are out in this cold world suffering, you know, my husband didn't talk to me nicely, or I had this problem at work, or the stocks went down, or I lost my job, or I don't have money, or you know, I have a small house, my neighbor has a big. So all those things continuously bother us. Physically, sometimes you may have ill health, or you may have health. Then emotionally, you know, sometimes you have joys and sorrow. Somebody loves me, somebody does not love me. You know, I got divorced, I got separated, my children don't call me, my children don't care for me, don't love me. Or intellectually, you know, I fail in something, I don't succeed, or I used to be so powerful and now nobody, I used to be president and now I'm just a resident. You know, I'm nobody. So either way, physically we have problems, you know, health is going down, I used to be very healthy and now I'm not. Mentally. So we are suffering in this world, but it says you have the key. And what is the key? The key is self-knowledge. And that lady speaking through the keyhole is the guru, who is telling us that, or the scriptures. The guru is interpreting the scriptures and telling us very softly that you have this golden key in your pocket to open and get into this world of the inner world of all warmth and joy and comfort and happiness. So we all have that. And that is, the key is knowledge. So through understanding the scriptures, through reading texts like these, and through meeting gurus like these Swamis and Acharyas who come here, they are all reminding us again and again that even Jesus says, you know, the kingdom of God lies within. He has said that. The idea being that ultimately, the knowledge and the joy is only within. You may live for 100 years. You may go through 10, 20 lifetimes. You may even go to heaven and come back. We say even heaven is a place where you go and come back. But until you get the self-knowledge of who you are, what is my true nature, One is my worldly nature, you know, one is my worldly description. I am, you know, a man or a woman, I'm a doctor or an engineer, I'm a housewife, I'm a mother, I'm a father, a brother, I'm a sister. Those are my empirical entities. Those are my worldly relationships. But there is a true essence, true nature, which I am and which is the one in all, the oneness. To experience that, you have to go inwards. Through that key of knowledge, you have to open the door. And meditation is one of the very direct techniques to take us there. Of course, meditation has to be accompanied by knowledge. You cannot just sit and say, meditate on I am that, I am that. No, not like that. Through reading the scriptures, reading the texts, understanding, and then when you sit and meditate and contemplate on your true nature, then you slowly open that door. So it's a gradual process. It's not going to happen overnight. It's not going to happen tomorrow. But as you slowly, slowly spend time, you will find that this knowledge will become clearer. My ignorance will go away. That just as an alcoholic needs a few hours, you know, before that, you know, that his confusion goes, and then slowly, slowly, he wakes up with a hangover and then finally gets over it. So for us also, this ignorance is a gradual removal. So that is basically the essence of this first verse. I prostrate to the Lord. I prostrate to my teacher. I bow down with humility so that I may get this knowledge. And the teacher says, I am telling you this. I am teaching you this for my own self-abidance. May I abide in my own self. So once you discover your own essence, your own truth, then you abide in that. So one is knowing spiritually, one is listening to the text, and the other one is experiencing it, becoming one with that knowledge, abiding in that. So that is the essence of this first verse. Next verse onwards, we'll talk about the student. What is this qualified student? Is any questions or comments? Yeah, abide. That's a good question. Abide means, like they said, abiding. Like where abiding means to live. Abide also means to follow the directions, like to abide by the rules. That's one meaning. But abide also means where do you live? So to stay in that knowledge. Here, abide means to be permanently established in that knowledge. So that's what this meaning here is. Nishtha, Atma Nishtha means abidance, means establishment, firm understanding and firm practice. So when that total thing happens, like you say, no, I abide by the rules, there you have understood the rules and then you practice them fully. So that is what it means, that you have understood this knowledge, you have applied that, and then you never get out of that ignorance. Never waver from that. Yes, that's correct. Always staying in that knowledge, in that state of, like a realized master, you know, once he or she has experienced that truth, then no matter what kind of problems come, the world may give them any kind of problems, but is not able to sway them. And that's why, that's what distinguishes them from us. Because in our case, the slightest problem comes and we run away, but they don't. They're able to stay firmly established in that truth. Maybe the cultures intermingled, because these were the two or three ancient cultures, you know, the Egyptian, the Indian, and the Chinese. And maybe they may have intermingled. You know, sometimes people may have gone from one culture to another. So it's possible that they may have. But it has been accepted that a lot of the Indian sailors from India did go all the way to Indonesia, to Malaysia, to the Philippines, and also came to South America. Because in Indonesia, a lot of the names are Indian names. Sukarna, Suharta, you know, all the Suharto. So and even the temples are very similar. Same thing in Malaysia, in the Philippines, and even in when you go to South America, if you go to their ancient temples, a lot of their ideas, like they worship the sun god, which was the, you know, and then they worship the Trinity, you know, like we have the Trinity, Brahma, Vishnu. So you can see some similarities in the art, in the architecture, in the culture. So these ancient people did travel a lot. They were very good sailors and they did navigate. So they did discover America before Columbus, if you want to believe that. But yeah, but at least up to the East Asia, Japan, and up to there, you find a lot of Indian names and Indian culture. A lot of Hindus are there still. So. Yeah, no, that's a very good point. One is the knowledge of the body. You know, am I healthy, unhealthy, and how my body functions. Then, she, as she said, psychology deals with the mind and the intellect. If I am mentally disturbed, then I go to a psychologist and she will, you know, go through counseling and advice and maybe even medications from a psychiatrist. So that is still at the level of the mind and the intellect. In self-knowledge, in meditation, we transcend the mind and the intellect and go even transcend our deepest desires, the vasanas, go towards the self. And here when we talk about the self, it is that God principle, the divinity in me, that is that we call as Atman or consciousness or the life. And so in meditation, we quieten the mind and the intellect. And with that quiet mind and intellect, ultimately even that mind and intellect disappears. And in that silence, the self-knowledge shines through. So the goal of self-knowledge is to know who I really am. And then you experience, once you experience that in reality, I am that infinite consciousness. I am not this body, mind, or intellect. They are my equipment with which I function. So even the mind and intellect become an object. Right now, the mind and intellect is so powerful, it has a grip on us where we say, I am that. I am the mind, I am the intellect, I am the body. The body identification is so strong, but in meditation, you gradually drop that and even make the mind and intellect an object, that I watch the mind and I watch the intellect and I watch the fluctuations of the emotions, I watch the fluctuations of the ideas, and I stay as the aham brahmasmi, I am that consciousness. So, yes, that this knowledge is more than, deeper than what is what is taught by psychologists or explained by them. Yes, it is beyond that. But I think it's a stepwise. At least first you have an identification, I am the body. Then you can slowly shift yourself to the subtler body. This is called, and ultimately to the truth.